There were many different motives for why the First World War was fought. Since 1871, Germany had emerged as a powerhouse, upsetting the long-established balance of power scheme in Europe. The established great powers, Britain, France, and Russia, joined together in 1914 to destroy this new rival.
On the 28th of June 1914, Gavrilo Princip, a Bosnian Serb and a failed student, assassinated the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, successor to the Austria-Hungarian throne. Austria-Hungary had signed the Defensive Pact with Germany, which Germany in 1909 reconfirmed by declaring that Germany was bound to stand by Austria-Hungary even if it had started a war. Austria declared war on Serbia, which started the First World War. Throughout the whole war, Germany wanted peace and had nothing to gain in the conflict whatsoever. Even if Germany was well on its way to win the war in December of 1916, Kaiser Wilhelm offered to negotiate peace with the Entente powers. By December 1916, Germany had a clear advantage. France had suffered horrible losses. Russia faced internal Bolshevik uprising and revolutionary chaos and had to withdraw its troops. Britain was under the U-boat blockade and not one inch of Germany had been occupied. Germany still offered generous peace terms. Kaiser Wilhelm was ready to just call off the war and return to how things were before. That was when the Zionist Jews, Chaim Weizmann and Nathan Sokolov, approached the British with a dirty deal. They offered to use their global influence to bring the US into the war on Britain's side, while undermining and destroying Germany from within. In exchange for US entry, the British would steal Palestine from Ottoman Turkey, which was Germany's ally, and then allow the Jews to settle there. The deal was called the Balfour Declaration and was delivered to the Baron Walter Rothschild. Jews in London then sent messages to Louis Brandeis, one of the Jewish members of the Supreme Court, instructing him to pressure President Wilson to join the war. Other Zionist power brokers such as Bernard Baruch, Paul Warburg, and Jacob Schiff also pressured America to join. The British government agreed that they would support a Jewish homeland in Palestine in exchange for the powerful Jewish lobby in America getting the USA to join the Allies. British airplanes dropped leaflets over Germany printed in Yiddish. The Balfour leaflets to win Jewish support in Germany by promising the Jews a homeland in Palestine after they have won the war.
And here it is, the Balfour Declaration. What do you feel when you see it here?
I genuinely feel it's one of the most extraordinary moments in the history of the Jewish people. If you think it took 3,000 years to get to this. And then you say, how did this miracle happen? It was the most incredible piece of opportunism. I mean, if you think you had an impoverished would-be scientist, Chaim Weizmann, who somehow gets to England, meets a few people, including members of my family, seduces them. He has such great charm and conviction. He gets to Balfour, and he unbelievably persuades Balfour and Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, and most of the ministers, that this idea of the national home for Jews should be allowed to take place.
After the deal was made, Jewish-owned media immediately unleashed a ton of anti-German propaganda, depicting the Germans as barbaric Huns. This was done to get the public support for American intervention in the war. While the Zionists and Jewish Marxists of Germany started to destabilize Germany from within through several strikes within the arms industry factories, which weakened the German war effort. If America wouldn't have been tricked into the war, it would have been stopped right there and then, and millions of European lives would have been saved. American entrance into the war was then carried out as promised. Lord Balfour was assuring the Zionists that Britain would fulfill its end of the deal after the war had ended, the theft and overthrowing of Palestine from the Ottoman Turks. Before more European blood would be shed on European soil, both Germany and Austria-Hungary again asked for a peaceful resolution. Wilson was forced to admit that Germany and Austria-Hungary had indeed expressed general peace proposals, but he casually dismissed them all. lying about how beautiful the post-war peace was going to be like, Wilson managed to trick so many war-weary Germans into an unconditional surrender and disarmament in November of that same year, 1918. Communists and Zionists within Germany stabbed their countrymen in the back. Marxist trade union leaders ordered factory strikes which deprived German troops of their vital supplies.
German morale and industrial output quickly fell. Germany laid down the weapons and wished for an honorary peace.
After the war, the treasonous betrayal of 1918 became known as the stab in the back. Germany had simply been betrayed from within by Zionists and communists. And consequently, they were all tied together as enemies because they wished to see Germany fail. In Israel today, Balfour Day, November the 2nd, is widely celebrated. The Palestinian Arabs observe it as a day of grief. In January 1919, the victors met at the Paris Peace Conference to financially crush Germany and determine the new borders of the defeated nation. Germany was not even invited and would not have any say in the final decisions as the globalists ripped Germany to pieces. The conference also created the basis for a future world government, the League of Nations. The Zionist delegation that was present that had brought America into the war also made sure that former Arab territories of the Ottoman Empire were separated from Turkish rule and broken up into small states so that Palestine could become a British protectorate.
The Jews then claimed to a piece of Palestine guaranteed by the League of Nations, exactly as Herzl had predicted in 1887. Out of the Paris Peace Conference came the brutal and notorious Treaty of Versailles on 20th of June 1919 and the Treaty of Saint-Germain on 20th of September the same year. Even liberal historians recognize the evil of the treaty today. A Germany that did not want any war, that had tried to avoid war, and had offered to make peace on numerous occasions throughout the whole war was now totally disarmed.
Germany was forced to pay massive war reparations in the form of money and natural resources. The crushing debt payments, 100 billion marks equal to $1 trillion in modern currency, devastated the German economy and soon caused a hyperinflationary monetary collapse. The total sum of war reparations demanded from Germany were about 226 billion marks. The aim was to financially break Germany. John Maynard Keynes predicted that these harsh reparations would lead to the financial collapse of Germany.
Germany's armed forces were restricted to 100,000 men, intended solely for police duties within the country, and conscription was prohibited. All German colonies were taken away from her. The same thing happened with a number of German areas in Europe. In total, Germany had to give up 13% of her lands. Several million Germans ended up stranded outside of the German Empire, and millions were forcefully expelled from their homes. Germany also lost large parts of their industry when key iron ore and coal assets disappeared. The industrial German Rhineland would be occupied by French troops for 15 years. The Treaty of Versailles was a devastating peace treaty for Germany, but the agreement also had serious economic consequences not only for Germany, but also for Europe and the world, as Germany was such an important brick in the world economy. The treaty contained 440 clauses, 414 out of them were specifically dedicated to punishing Germany for a war that the nation was totally innocent of.
In The Times, 1919, Winston Churchill expressed the ultimate goal of the treaty. Should Germany do business again in the next 50 years, we have led this war in vain. The encirclement and unprecedented hunger blockade killed almost a million of German children, women, old men, and the most fragile of society. The Allies now had only one fixed intention, to prolong the power of Versailles and to destroy Germany for good. Germany was now completely disarmed and she had been damaged on all sides and had no way of defending herself. At any moment could her neighbors decide to attack her. Because of the enormous reparation costs to be paid in gold, there was no longer any backing for the mark. This led to inflation, which totally wiped out all the German savings. Germany in 1922-23 faced the most horrific hyperinflation the world has ever seen, and the German mark became worthless. Unemployment, hunger, and a hopeless future distinguished the Weimar Republic to the German people. Suicide rates were high. Unemployment topped 30% as desperate Germans committed suicide. Birth rates were extremely low. Anarchy and chaos was in the air. There was nothing the disarmed, humiliated, and hungry German people could do about it, as communists even seized parts of many cities. In 1929, the Federal Reserve caused the Great Depression. The researcher Boris Borisov, in his article titled The American Famine, estimated the victims of the financial crisis in the US at over 7 million people. The globalist powers had now managed to orchestrate yet another famine that killed millions of white Europeans like in Russia before. Ben Bernanke said, regarding the Great Depression, "We did it." By we, Bernanke of course meant the Jewish leaders of the Federal Reserve System. Back in Germany, the effects of the engineered stock market crash was even worse than in any other country, as the life savings of the people were wiped out as prices doubled every 2 days for 20 straight months.
In 1922, inflation was spiraling wildly out of control. People would be paid in the morning and have suitcase fulls of banknotes, and they would have to then run to the shops, because in the time between being paid and the time when they bought their goods, their food, the prices would have risen. Berlin was in a state of total chaos. Hundreds of thousands of dispossessed starving in the streets, and at the same time you had very rich people. So you got, on the one hand, the poor eating turnip soup, the butchers selling crows, squirrels, even rats, and on the other side, people who could afford it eating the most sumptuous meals like they never paused for thought.
The Germans had to pay 2 to 20 billion marks for a single postage stamp. A loaf of bread cost 2 billion marks. A pound of butter cost 2 trillion marks. The German middle class was the worst hit and saw all their savings and businesses being destroyed. Starving families and their children begged on the streets. Many Germans referred to their devalued money as Judefetzen, Jewish confetti. Because whilst the Germans were starving, the Jewry lived their golden luxury life in the Republic. Germany was totally bankrupt in the end of 1929. The Jewish statistician Alfred Marcus estimated the average Jewish income for 1930 as 3 times the average income for the rest of the population. The industries, as in the Ruhr, were all bankrupt and workers were all laid off in their millions. In January 1933, over 6 million Germans were unemployed. Although the Jews comprised less than 1% of the German population, the political influence of the Jews in the Weimar Republic was enormously out of proportion to their numbers in the population. They managed to control over 50% of the media and the press, and 70% of all the judges, 57% of the metal trade, 22% of grain, and 39% of the textile trade. German banking and finance was under the total control of Jews. They were particularly evident in the private banking in Berlin, which in 1923 had 150 private Jewish banks, as opposed to only 11 private non-Jewish banks. 4 of the 6 members of the controlling board of the Reichstag directors were Jews, including Jacob Goldschmidt and Rudolf Habenstein. In order for anyone to control people's minds, one has to control the press and media. Jewish domination of the press and the public mind began with Reuters News Agency in 1865. Established by the Jew Paul Reuter, born Israel Bere Yosafat in 1865, the Reuters Telegram Company was the first major news organization in the world. Almost every major news outlet in the world today subscribes to Reuters services, which operates in over 200 cities in 94 countries in about 20 languages. The Washington Post was controlled by Zionist Federal Reserve Chairman Eugene Meyer. In 1940, Major would fire the Washington Post pacifist editor for refusing to endorse U.S. involvement in World War II. Post would later be handed down to Major's daughter, the late Catherine Major Graham. In 1896, Adolf Ochs bought the New York Times and formed the New York Times Company. The Ochs-Sulzberger family, one of the United States newspaper dynasties, has owned the New York Times ever since. For 117 years, America's most influential news source has been in the hands of this same family. In 1926, the Jew David Sarnoff formed NBC, the first major broadcast network in the U.S. In 1928, the 27-year-old Jewish businessman William S. Paley secured majority ownership of the CBS radio network. Paley expanded CBS into a national powerhouse with 114 affiliate stations. It is very important to remember that the four most powerful media sources, the Washington Post, the New York Times, NBC, and CBS, were now all under total Jewish ownership and control. Jewish Daily Bulletin on July 27, 1935, said, "There is only one power which really counts, the power of political pressure. We Jews are the most powerful people on earth because we have this power and we know how to apply it." The two largest German newspapers before 1933 were also in Jewish hands, Leopold Ullstein, August Scherl, and Rudolf Moss. These Jews had a virtual monopoly on the German press. Their main publication was the Berliner Tageblatt. The editor of this paper was Theodor Wolff, a Jew, who also took a prominent part in politics. All editorials, all policy, all thought, and every single sphere of major influence had now fallen under Jewish control. Of the 29 legitimate theaters in Berlin, 23 had Jewish directors. In 1931, of 144 film scripts made into movies, 119 were written by Jews, and 77 were produced by Jews.
When you ask what have the Germans done to the Jews, you must always ask what have done the Jews to the Germans.
In 1918, Lenin and Trotsky established a Communist International, also known as the Comintern, in Moscow, Russia. In the days following the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, Trotsky promoted the idea of a permanent revolution, which meant that the Soviet Union had to politically provoke other nations throughout the world to start their own Bolshevik revolutions. The Comintern stated openly that its intention was to fight for the creation of an international Soviet republic, i.e. a communist world government. Comintern-affiliated parties formed in France, Italy, China, Germany, Spain, Belgium, the US, and other nations. The ideology of communism spread like a poison through Europe. The author Ernst Elmhirst explained in 1938 that socialism, communism, and Bolshevism in reality are only links in the plan of world embracing Judaism, with its final purpose of forcing the entire world under Jewish domination. Following the Russian Revolution of 1917, revolutionary Jewish communist leaders Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg led a group of Jewish communists, Kurt Eisner, Paul Levy, Franz Mehring, Wilhelm Pieck, Richard Müller, Emil Bacht, Gustav Landauer, Eugene Levine, and Emil Eichhorn to attempt a violent and bloody communist revolution in Germany as well. They were heroically stopped in 1919 by the veterans in the German Freikorps. The Jew Bela Kun instigated a Jewish revolution and took over the leadership of Hungary in March 1919. After months of red terror and massacres of Christians, the Hungarians managed to fight back. Hungarian Rear Admiral Miklós Horthy formed a national army to fight the Bolsheviks. With the support of the Romanian army, Portthief managed to take back the country on August 1, 1919. In Italy, Jewish-led communists committed mass murders in Sarana, Modena, Bologna, Pietro, Diana, and Milan, but were defeated by Mussolini's fascist forces. Fascism was a movement to save Europe from communism. Today, thanks to our globalist media, almost everyone thinks that fascism was something horrible. Fascism is, shortly, a defender of the nation, its culture, and people. Under fascism, government plays a key role in monitoring film, theater, art, literature, music, education, etc. in order to maintain a high moral standard, keep things clean and respectable, promote a strong sense of patriotism and honor, and prevent the spreading of decadence which corrupts society from within. Even Winston Churchill thought that fascism proved the necessary antidote to the communist poison. He said of Mussolini, "Roman genius, the greatest lawgiver among men." Speaking in Rome on January 20, 1927, Winston Churchill said, "If I'd been an Italian, I am sure that I should have been wholeheartedly with you from the start to the finish. Italy has shown that there is a way of fighting the subversive forces which can rally the masses of the people, properly led to value and wish to defend the honor and stability of civilized society. Hereafter, no great nation will be unprovided with an ultimate means of protection against the cancerous growth of Bolshevism." 12 years later, Winston Churchill will align his country and people with Bolshevism. Oswald Mosley was the fascist leader of Britain and tried to save his country as well, but never managed to get enough power. Cornelio Cadrano said, "Fascism means, first of all, defending your nation against the dangers that threaten it. It means the destruction of these dangers and the opening of a free way to life and glory for your nation." Jewish Bolsheviks then attempted to take Spain in 1936, which led to the bloody Spanish Civil War. The Jews launched an orgy of mass murder, rape, and destruction. The Jew Leyba Lazarevich Feldbin, Soviet Red Army officer, was chief of Soviet security in the Spanish Civil War. Over 20,000 churches across Spain were destroyed, 6,832 Spanish priests, 3,000 monks, 300 nuns, and 13 bishops were killed. Some 4,000 laymen were also murdered for helping or hiding nuns for priests. Feldbin was one of the masterminds behind the massacres. In 1939, the devout Roman Catholic general Francisco Franco stepped up and created a United Nationalist group and managed to save Spain from a communist takeover. Franco had the support of Antonio Salazar in Portugal, Benito Mussolini in Italy, and Adolf Hitler in Germany. On February 8, 1920, Sir Winston Churchill expressed his alarm over the world developments in an interview published in the Sunday Illustrated Herald, London. "From the days of Adam Spartacus Weishaupt, to those of Karl Marx, to those of Trotsky, Bella Kuhn, Rosa Luxemburg, and Emma Goldman, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstruction of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence and impossible equality, has been steadily growing." Ideological and cultural subversion is a subtle, gradual, and persistent undermining internally of another group's values, strength, and ways of life, with the aim of making them vulnerable. This is the strategy that the communists used when they infiltrated and took over societies from within, starting with Germany. The four stages of subversion are demoralization, destabilization, crisis, and normalization.
The Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion. What do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the process which is legitimate, overt, and open. You can see it with your own eyes. All you have to do, all American mass media has to do, is to unplug their bananas from their ears, open up their eyes, and they can see it. Only about 15% of time, money, and manpower is spent on espionage as such. The other 85% is a slow process which we call either ideological subversion, or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. For the last 25 years, actually it's overfulfilled, because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who was demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camp, he will refuse to believe it until he is going to receive a kick in his fat bottom. When a military boot crashes his, then he will understand, but not before that. That's the tragic of the situation of demoralization. So the next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and flabby, doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation, it's what matters is essentials: economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense and economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world, that the process will go that fast. The next stage, of course, is crisis. It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now. And after crisis, with a violent change of power, structure, and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kind of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C., who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfillable or not. Your leftists in the United States, all these professors and all these beautiful civil rights defenders, they are instrumental in the process of the subversion, only to destabilize the nation. When their job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. Some of them, when they get disillusioned, when they see that Marxist-Lenin has come to power, obviously they get offended. They think that they will come to power. That will never happen, of course. They will be lined up against the wall and shot.
Towards the end of 1922, the Communist International, Comintern, began to consider how they would succeed taking over Europe in the most effective way. On Lenin's initiative, a meeting was organized at the Marx-Engels Institute in Moscow. The aim of the meeting was to start the Marx Cultural Revolution. Among those present at the meeting was George Lukács, a Jewish Hungarian aristocrat and a son of a banker. In the summer of 1924, Lukács moved to Germany. Here he held the first meeting of a group of communist-oriented intellectuals. This gathering was to lead the foundation of the Frankfurt School. The institute had been officially established and funded by the Jewish millionaire Felix Weil. This institute was called the Institute for Social Research. Later it would be known as the Frankfurt School. These new Marxists, under the direction of Max Horkheimer, believed that Europeans were too attached to tradition, race, nation, family, and faith to be able to accept communism. Antonio Gramsci, while in prison, described that Marxism and communism could only flourish after a long march through the cultural institutions. Only then, after they had corrupted all Western values and made life impossible for us, could they impose the dictatorship of the proletariat. This was also what the Fabian socialists did to weaken the countries and slowly implementing international communism. The mantra would now be change and destroy Western culture before communism would be accepted. George Lukács believed that for a new communist culture to emerge, the existing European culture had to be destroyed.
There is no other way to get control of a society with strong moral values than to weaken those values.
He said, "I saw the revolutionary destruction of society as the one and only solution to the cultural contradictions of the epoch. Such a worldwide overturning of values cannot take place without the annihilation of the old values and the creation of new ones by the revolutionaries." Willy Münzenberg said, "We must organize the intellectuals and use them to make Western civilization stink. Only then, after they had corrupted all its values and made life impossible, can we impose the dictatorship of the proletariat." In his 1915 book, The Spirit of Militarism, Nahum Goldmann, top-level international Zionist and the president of the World Jewish Congress, describes the Zionist method for destruction of Western civilization, which is required for transition into a new world order. "The historical mission of our world revolution is to rearrange a new culture of humanity to replace the previous social systems. This conversion and reorganization of global society requires two essential steps. Firstly, the destruction of the old established order. Secondly, design and imposition of the new order. The first stage requires elimination of all frontier borders, nationhood, and culture, public policy, ethical barriers, and social definitions. Only then can the destroyed old system elements be replaced by the imposed system elements of our new order. The first task of our world revolution is destruction. All social strata and social formations created by the traditional society must be annihilated. Individual men and women must be uprooted from their ancestral environment, torn out of their native environments. No tradition of any type shall be permitted to remain as sacred. Traditional social norms must only be viewed as a disease to be eradicated. The ruling dictum of the new order is, nothing is good, so everything must be criticized and abolished. Everything that was must be gone. After destruction of the old order, construction of the new order is a larger and more difficult task. We will have torn out the old limbs from their ancient roots in deep layers. Social norms will be lying disorganized and anarchic, so they must be blocked against new cultural forms and social categories naturally re-emerging. The general masses will have been first persuaded to join as equals in the first task of destroying their own traditional society and economic culture. But then, The new order must be forcibly established through people again, being divided and differentiated only in accordance with the new pyramidal hierarchical system of our imposed global monolithic new world order. Max Horkheimer, Jewish intellectual of the Frankfurt School, explained, "The revolution won't happen with guns. Rather, it will happen incrementally, year by year, generation by generation. We will gradually infiltrate their educational institutions and their political offices, transforming them slowly into Marxist entities as we move towards universal egalitarianism." Out of this came cultural Marxism, the subversive ideology which meant that gender, sexual orientation, family, race, culture, or religion, every single aspect of a white person's identity was to be questioned, every norm or standard in a society challenged and ideally altered and demolished in order to benefit supposedly oppressed groups instead of Europeans. This would supposedly create a society in which the Jews would not be seen as an outside distinctive class, where they could feel safer to climb to the highest positions in society without encountering much opposition from Europeans. The entire purpose of cultural Marxism was to delegitimize and banish European ethnic interests and replace them with minorities.
When I started writing about Jewish intellectual movements, I realized I couldn't just go around counting Jews. And what I had to show was that you had a cohesive core of Jews that were mutually reinforcing each other, that they were the backbone of this movement. And I had to show that these people identified as Jews. And I had to show that they viewed what they were doing as furthering specific Jewish goals. For example, one of the most common things was that they were concerned about anti-Semitism. Quite a bit of my writing in my book, The Culture of Critique, was to show that the Jews who were the center of these Jewish intellectual movements were very concerned about issues like anti-Semitism, that they were trying to develop theories in which anti-Semitism was a pathology, in which anti-Semitism had no intellectual basis, in which it was just morally beyond the pale. Important thing was to show that Jewish identification was important in furthering of a specific Jewish goal. Now, that's not to say that this was a goal that all Jews have. We're not saying that all Jews are anything, as a matter of fact. For example, psychoanalysis had specific goals. They were concerned about anti-Semitism. But that doesn't mean that most Jews even believe in psychoanalysis or anything else. We're talking about a cohesive group of people. It's very easy to show that the Frankfurt School intellectuals, Max Horkheimer, Adorno, and these other prominent Frankfurt School people had strong Jewish identities. Franz Boas, the famous anthropologist, very strong Jewish identity, a very deep concern with specific Jewish issues like anti-Semitism, and that they saw their particular intellectual endeavors as advancing specific Jewish goals. There's nothing wrong with advancing your own goals. That's what we all do. The only thing is that those goals oftentimes conflict with those of other people. And so essentially, for example, at the Frankfurt School, you developed an ideology in which any group identification that a non-Jew had was considered a pathology. So that if someone like me identified as a white person and had, you know, felt I had interest as a white person, well, that was viewed as a psychiatric disorder. There was never any mention about Jews that is strong, with a very strong sense of Jewish identity and Jewish interest, that there's anything wrong with them. It was an ideology that really framed adaptive behaviors of non-Jews as pathological. Even family life, that non-Jews with strong family ties and so on, there's something wrong with them. Their families were authoritarian, and they did all the psychoanalytic stuff to try to prove that sort of thing. But it was just, you know, made-up science and no scientific basis at all.
After Marx, there were a group of Marxists who wisely decided that you could bring this collectivist society to a nation through culture as well. by introducing certain values and concepts that would break down the family, for example. If you could somehow break down the family unit so that it was no longer self-sustaining and no longer valued in a society, then that would leave individual members who formerly could turn to the family for support in times of need. They would now be cut loose. They would be without a place to go in times of need, so now they have to turn to the government. So cultural Marxism would be that type of activity in any society that breaks down the culture in such a way so that people instinctively turn to government as an alternative for the support that they otherwise would have. This is done through art, it's through music, it's through literature, it's through motion pictures and that kind of thing. The implanting of certain ideas and concepts which make them very ripe for the philosophy of collectivism and makes them very ripe for turning to government as the big daddy, the big solver of all problems. Collectivism implies that if something is important enough, then the state should step in and make sure that everybody conforms, whether they want to or not.
The whole point of a socialistic society is to do four things. Marx talks about destroying the family, two, destroying property, three, destroying religion, and four, destroying the nation. And what you end up with is the gulag, where the whole country becomes the Soviet Union.
Almost every movie that Hollywood puts out today must depict characters with at least one of the following attributes. One, the protagonist and or the antagonist are divorced. Two, the female is portrayed as dominant, controlling, violent, and or one up on men. Three, the male is portrayed as aloof, feminine, overly sensitive, and or cheating. Four, somewhere in the family, at least one of its immediate members must be a lesbian, gay, bisexual, or a women's lover. Often, attributes are mixed in various proportions, and even mixed with a touch of schizophrenia, as males and females swap roles in fluorescence.
One of the big themes in movies in recent years has been that the whites have almost tended to disappear from positions of being heroes, of being sort of idealized or something like that. In the place, you have people like Morgan Freeman, who's cast as very responsible, moral, godlike figure, and so on. Or you have action figures like Will Smith and Wesley Snipes and so on. So you have an awful lot of sort of displacement of whites as media images in the last few decades. And whites are all often criminals. You often have blonde-haired, blue-eyed people playing criminal roles, playing people who are dishonest or weak or subservient, and the black characters being very strong, very wise. You'll often see, of course, black computer technicians, black scientists, black teachers and professors who are very wise and understand everything. Whites are portrayed as stupid, oftentimes as irresponsible, oftentimes as needing the advice of black people or other minorities. It's really the visual displacement of whites from center stage to the periphery. And I think this is preparing the white people for their displacement in the culture as a whole.
Freud was given the enormous buildup he received for his theorizing about anal personalities and penis envy and the like because he was a Jew, not because of any genuine merit in his theorizing. And his theories ultimately did an enormous amount of damage to the development of our understanding of psychology and mental disease.
My dad says white people suck. Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. Nailed him, right? Boom.
What can possibly compensate white Americans for the deliberate corruption of our young people by just one Jewish gangster like Sumner Redstone and his MPV? The race mixing, culture destroying, filth churned out by Sumner Redstone's MPV is the single most destructive influence in American life today. And of course, Redstone doesn't produce this filth all by himself. He has thousands of Jews working for him at every level, not only in MTV, but also in CBS and in Paramount Pictures and in all of his other media properties. And although MTV, targeting white teenagers as it does, may seem the most blatantly and maliciously destructive, it is hardly much worse than some of the filth by Michael Eisner's Disney empire, especially by its Miramax Films division under the Weinstein brothers. The poison is being introduced gradually, more and more each year, and it is having its effect. When the Disney company was entirely a Gentile company, none of it was poison designed to corrupt Americans. Davy Crockett. And what can possibly compensate on our balance sheet for what the Jewish news media are doing in their deliberate distortion of the picture of the world seen by the American public? It is a picture designed to confuse white Americans, to undermine their self-confidence, to induce feelings of racial guilt in them. Just one example, the suppression of the news of black crimes against white people and the exaggeration of every white crime against non-whites is not a fluke. It is done routinely by all of the Jewish news media. An interracial crime is just one issue. The relations between the sexes, immigration, the foreign relations of the United States with the rest of the world, and 100 other important issues are similarly distorted in their portrayal by the media. This deliberate distortion has done irreparable damage to American society. And again, the distortion has been deliberate, planned, systematic, and intended to do harm to us.
Göran Rosenberg, Swedish Jewish author and journalist, explains the drive behind the push for destroying white countries by means of cultural Marxism. Historically, Jews had always thrived in nations and empires with multicultural, pluralistic, and tolerant environments, while they fared badly in strong ethnic or nationalistic societies. European Jews have always been the emblematic stranger or other. Therefore, by definition, a society where the stranger is welcome is good for the Jews. The future of European Jewry is dependent on our ability to shape a multicultural, pluralistic, and diverse society. The website smashculturalmarxism.com explains the phenomenon of cultural Marxism extremely well. Cultural Marxism, or cultural Bolshevism, degenerate culture, seeks to destroy everything good about society, what holds it together, what helps it to advance, what promotes intelligence and beauty. It seeks to degenerate society and take it to a lower form where people are less intelligent and more animal. It's based on the Marxist lie that everything good about society is all form of oppression. Every time anyone promotes cultural Marxism, they use the same line claiming it's about freeing people from oppression. These common cultural Marxist themes are all promoted by the same lie that they are done in the name of freedom. Liberalism, sexual perversion, degenerate art, degenerate music, mass immigration, anti-intelligence, and promotion of people acting like animals, corrupted versions of feminism, multiculturalism, oppressing people of European ancestry, and destroying nationalism and destroying non-Jewish religion. Cultural Marxism is largely a synthesis of Marx and Freud. It is Marxism as applied in the cultural sphere and the analysis and control of the media, art, theater, film, and other cultural institutions in society, often with an emphasis on class, gender, and race. As a form of political analysis, cultural Marxism gained strength in the 1920s and was the model used by a group of intellectuals in Germany known as the Frankfurt School, and later by another group of intellectuals at the Center of Contemporary Cultural Studies in Birmingham, England. The fields of cultural studies and critical theory are rooted in and influenced by work of cultural Marxism. Cultural Marxism is formulated as a way to subvert European nations and civilization using methods other than direct political action. Theodor Adorno was also an original member of the Frankfurt School. With the help of the American Jewish Committee, he wrote a book entitled The Authoritarian Personality. The book's purpose was to make every group affiliation sound as if it were a sign of mental disorder. Patriotism, religion, family, and race loyalty were signs of a dangerous and defective authoritarian personality. The school's critical theory preached that the authoritarian personality was a product of the patriarchal family. This was one of the basic principles of cultural Marxism, the need to break down the family unit.
Frankfurt School, at its base, developed the ideology that you had to sort of reject your family. By rejecting your family, you would then be more likely to accept, or you would be less likely to be anti-Jewish. And so, you know, it's a remarkable thing because they never supposed that Jewish children should reject their parents. If you're going to promulgate Judaism to the next generation, you have to have children who identify with their parents. But in the authoritarian personality, identifying with your parents, who were Christian especially, was the epitome of pathology. This had to be eradicated. But you see what the authoritarian personality is, holding out individualism, radical individualism, as a cultural ideal. Now, of course, individualism is a long roots in European society. But what you're talking about with radical individualism is giving up all your allegiances. You just become the isolated individual. This is not a prescription that Jews have ever adopted. I mean, if there's anything that is characteristic of Judaism, it's a strong sense of identification with a group. So essentially, this is a prescription for the behavior of Gentiles that would essentially make them less likely to have allegiances with other groups. Because what, from the standpoint of Jews, what is the most terrifying thing is a group of non-Jews united by an ideology where they have a strong sense of group membership and which Jews are viewed negatively. I mean, the paradigm of that would be, of course, National Socialism in Germany from 1933 to 1945. Fundamentally, what Nazism was about was having a strong sense of being a member of a nation, having a strong sense that you're part of an in-group, and these other people are not, you know, you're not on their page, Jews especially. And so one way to get rid of that, basically, is to advocate individualism for everybody. Get rid of your allegiances. Don't have any allegiance to religion, country, race, even family. And again, one of the points I keep making there is that this is completely hypocritical, because to be a strong identified Jew means that you are highly connected to a group, that you have a strong sense of group membership, that you think of outgroups as potentially threatening, as enemies, and so on. In other words, the psychological processes of a group membership tend to make us view negatively the people in other groups, and that applies to Jews as well as anybody else. So strongly identified Jews tend to have strongly positive views of their in-group, strongly negative views of the outsiders. And, you know, that's part of the culture of critique. These Jewish intellectuals have very negative views about the culture and peoples of the outside them.
In the book, Adorno defined parenthood, pride in one's family, Christianity, adherence to traditional gender roles, and attitudes towards sex, and a love of one's own country as pathological phenomena. Cultural Marxists wanted to create conflict between the oppressed minority and the oppressing majority, between those with alleged privilege and those without it. The working class had been replaced by minorities. All allegiance to family, nation, and culture was seen as major obstacles and sources of anti-Semitism. In order for them to get rid of all resistance to the Jewish interest, it would have to be crushed and eroded within every white person. Nationalism, racial realism, heterosexuality, sovereignty, homogeneity, traditionalism, loyalty, and the nuclear family were looked upon as major obstacles to the communist takeover of Western civilization. Thus, the cultural Marxists came up with ways of gradually breaking up our culture from within. The Marxist idea of equality is not actually possible to achieve in reality. It is only about bringing down the ones who stand out, the successful, the hardworking achievers, to the same level as those who do nothing, fail, and are lazy. This is how you make everyone, quote-unquote, equal. To undermine Western civilization, the Jewish extremists called for the most negative and destructive criticism possible of every sphere of the Gentiles' life. Their anti-white policies, they anticipated, would later spread like a virus. Cultural Marxism has given us anti-white policies such as racism offenses and hate speech laws, gender confusion, hookup culture, moral and gender racial relativization, homosexualization of children, mass immigration, racial tensions, forced multiculturalism, the systematic promotion of sexual deviances in society, an unreliable legal system with bias against the victim of the crimes, the breakdown of the nuclear family, and low birth rates. Notable philosophers from the Frankfurt School were Herbert Marcuse, Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, Walter Benjamin, Erich Fromm, Friedrich Pollock, Leo Löwenthal, Jürgen Habermas, Alfred Schmidt, Axel Honneth, Siegfried Kakaur, George Lukács. All of these intellectuals at the Frankfurt School were Jewish. The intellectuals were first to be targeted in all communist states. Free thinking is dangerous to the system. Social justice and feminism, to name but a few, are all anti-white, anti-free speech movements inspired by and born out of critical theory, and thus come under the umbrella of cultural Marxism. A popular manifestation of cultural Marxism is also political correctness, which the great English writer Theodore Dalrymple eloquently defines like this. In my study of communist societies, I came to the conclusion that the purpose of communist propaganda was not to persuade or convince, not to inform, but to humiliate. And therefore, the less it corresponded to reality, the better. When people are forced to remain silent when they are being told the most obvious lies, or even worse, when they are forced to repeat the lies themselves, they lose once and for all their sense of probity. To assent to obvious lies is, in some way, to become evil oneself. One's standing to resist anything is thus eroded and even destroyed. A society of emasculated liars is easy to control. I think if you examine political correctness, it has the same effect and is intended to. Feminism was part of the Jewish group evolutionary strategy, which came out of the think tank known as the Frankfurt School. Its goal was to cause resentment, division, and weaken the relationships between men and women in the Gentile society, to destroy the institute of marriage and the sanctity of the family. Women would be turned into working units. Feminism is the idea that women are free when they serve their employers, but slaves when they help their husbands. Through promoting abortion and radical feminism, the sexes would turn against each other and consequently lower their demography by preventing childbirth. Feminist propaganda would brainwash white women that marriage constitutes slavery for them, and that freedom for women cannot be won without the abolition of marriage and traditional relationships.
Jewish intellectuals, Jewish activists have been very involved in feminism, for example. There has been a tendency to see the white male as someone, as something that has to be sort of demoted in society. But because there's no question that, say, in the year 1950, that white males ran the show in America. Feminism, you know, women were happy to stay at home and have children. Now women are encouraged to go off and have careers, and they have very few children. You know, my view is that it would be far better, I think a lot more women would be happier being wives and mothers than they would be getting into the world of work where they had to be competitive. They have to sort of pretty much put the family in the back burner.
Sexism was an epithet coined by the abortion-promoting feminist Jew Margaret Feldman. This epithet would be used to attack any person who uphold the natural order and mutually complementary roles of the sexes in society. Feminism has absolutely nothing to do with protecting women. It is a cultural Marxist program to degrade and subjugate white men, and of course also white women.
Well, one of the things they told me was that he was at the house one night, and we were talking, and he started laughing. He said, "Aaron, what do you think women's liberation was about?" And I said, I had pretty conventional thinking about it at that point. I said, "I think it's about women having the right to work, getting equal pay with men, just like they won the right to vote. you know? And he started to laugh. He said, you're an idiot. And I said, why am I an idiot? He said, you want me? Let me tell you what that was about. We, the Rockefellers, funded that. We funded Women's Lib, you know? And we're the ones who got all over the newspapers and television, the Rockefeller Foundation. He says, and you want to know why? He says, there were two primary reasons. And they were, one reason was, we couldn't tax half the population before Women's Lib. And the second reason was, now we get the kids in school at an early age. We can indoctrinate the kids how to think. It breaks up the family. The kids start looking at the state as the family, as the school, as the officials, as their family, not as the parents teaching them. And so those are the two primary reasons for Women's Lib, which I thought up to that point was a noble thing. You know, when I saw their intentions behind it, where they were coming from when they created it, the thought of it, I saw the evil behind what I thought was a noble venture.
The Jewish radical feminist Robin Morgan stated that, I feel that man-hating is an honorable and viable political act, that the oppressed have a right to class hatred against the class that is oppressing them. We can't destroy the inequities between men and women until we destroy marriage. Linda Gordon, Jewish feminist and historian, explains that the nuclear family must be destroyed. Whatever its ultimate meaning, the breakup of families now is an objectively revolutionary process. In order to do this, Jewish feminist Andrea Dworkin stated that they will have to destroy the structure of culture as we know it. Its art, its churches, its laws, its nuclear families based on fatherhood and nation states. She continues, I want to see a man beaten to a bloody pulp with a high heel shoved in his mouth, like an apple in the mouth of a pig. The Jewish feminist Susan Sontag says that the white race is the cancer of human history.
Fighting for gay marriage generally involves lying about what we're going to do with marriage when we get there. You know, because we lie that the institution of marriage is not going to change. And that is a lie. The institution of marriage is going to change, and it should change. And again, I don't think it should exist.
The hyperinflation of Germany attracted the international community to Berlin, and it was known as the moral cesspit of Europe, where any and every deprived sexual activity could be had. The cultural Marxist Jews had introduced decadence and immorality into German culture, movies, art, and theater.
That's why people saw Berlin as the Babylon of the 20s.
Things that had been considered to be immoral, amoral, whatever, were became irrelevant, and anything went.
Prostitution was legalized in 1927. Mother and daughter teams offered their services to the same client simultaneously. There were no fewer than 17 different prostitute types in this brothel city.
There were clubs where lesbians liked to whip schoolboys, and you'd find military officers sitting there with children sitting on their laps. So a lot of it was play acting, but there were quite a lot of people who also indulged in it.
The first homosexual and transsexual propaganda theater plays were made in Berlin in the 1920s. The first adultery theater plays were made by Jewish authors.
Places that you hadn't noticed would turn into outrageous strip clubs. The basements of the restaurants would be homosexual or lesbian romper rooms and sex clubs. When you have unemployed, you also have an increase in sex workers. But it wasn't just Berliners. It was tens and maybe hundreds of thousands of young boys and young girls who were coming to Berlin to participate in this hard currency sex traffic.
It was a city that was filled with lesbian life. There was the idea that everywhere you went, you didn't have to hide what you were.
Pedophilia was normalized. Underage girls managed to make a lucrative living in Berlin as prostitutes. Little girls were freely available and could be ordered by telephone and deliver like takeaway meals to clients.
Every intellectual was leftish. The whole political right wing, which basically came from Munich, did not play any role in the beginning. The whole town was in the hands of leftish ideas.
Dr. Manfred Reifer, a well-known leader of the Jews of Bukovina, said, "Whilst large sections of the German nation were struggling for the preservation of their race, we Jews filled the streets of Germany with our vociferations. We supplied the press with articles on the subjects of its Christmas and Easter, and administered to its religious beliefs in the manner we considered suitable. We ridiculed the highest ideals of the German nation, and profaned the matters which it holds sacred. Jewish-owned publishing houses like Benjamin Harz, Leon Hirsch, and Jacob Stahl & Company were distributing books that openly undermined Western traditional values. Jews also pushed an intensive campaign for free abortion, as Dr. Max Hodden, Dr. Lothar Wolff, Martha Rubin-Wolf, Alphonse Goldschmidt wrote numerous articles encouraging abortion and birth control for the Germans to lower their birth rates even further. Leading the film and theater businesses were Jews such as Joseph von Sternberg, Bertolt Brecht, Erich Pommer, and a host of other Jews. Research into sexuality was led by Jewish sexologists Ivan Bloch and Magnus Hirschfeld. The transgender community encouraged primitive sex operations because men and women no longer felt comfortable in their natural roles. With prostitution, drugs, pedophilia, homosexuality, adultery, sadism, masochism, decadent art, and even bestiality rampant, Germany was an unsafe place for the traditional German family. The conservative Germans looked at Berlin with disdain, destroying what was left of the national spirit. Criminal gangs lived from prostitution, drug trafficking, illegal gambling, pornography, robbery, and burglary. The police were underpaid, corrupt, and felt totally powerless because of the constitutional limitations of police authority. Maurice Samuel was a Romanian-born Jewish and Zionist novelist, translator, and lecturer. In 1924, he stated explicitly in his own book, You Gentiles, that we Jews, we are the destroyers, and will remain the destroyers forever. Nothing that you will do will meet our needs and demands. We will forever destroy, because we want a world of our own. The Jew Dr. Kurt Münzer wrote in his novel, Der Weg nach Zion, The Way to Zion, we have corrupted the blood of all the races of Europe. Perhaps we have infected them. Today, everything is Judified. Our thinking is in everything living. Our spirit rules the world. We are the masters. For everything that has power today is the child of our spirit. One may hate us, one may drive us away, our enemies may triumph over our physical weakness, but we are no longer to be gotten rid of. We have devoured the peoples, conquered their races, defiled them, broken their strength, made everything rotten, lazy, and corrupt with our stale culture. Our spirit can no longer be exterminated. Rabbi Harry Watton said, "The communist soul is the soul of Judaism. When we look deeper into the nature of communism, we see that it's essentially nothing else than Judaism. Since the Jews are the highest and most cultural people on earth, the Jews have a right to subordinate to themselves the rest of mankind and to be the masters over the whole world. The Jews will become the masters over the whole earth, and they will subordinate to themselves all nations. Judaism is communism, internationalism, the universal brotherhood of man, the emancipation of the working class, and the human society. It is with these spiritual weapons that the Jews will conquer the world and the human race. The Aryans will be destroyed, and Marxism will triumph." The honest Weimar Jewish poet Stefan Zweig now feared a backlash against Jewry, saying, "It's disgusting how Jews are taking everything by storm. Should it not be our responsibility to anticipate the justified anti-Semitic indignation and call our people back to their senses?"